or some galaxy far, far away. Many, including some very distinguished investigators, still believe that theory. But other suggested origins, such as secret underground civilizations, parallel worlds existing in slightly different states of matter, and time travelers that may be our future selves, continue to spring up. Notice, please, that these UFO origin categories are the same theories of origin often applied to upright, hairy monsters and other unknown creatures. But both the solid-appearing nuts-and-bolts UFOs, as well as the more ethereal ones that appear to morph or vanish, have sometimes been associated with windows or out-of-place openings into what looks like another time or world, separate from, but perhaps alien and parallel to, our own earthly domain. In some cases, people claim to have seen UFOs sailing in and out of these portals, while sometimes the UFO and the portal appear one and the same, as the sky objects beam up people and animals and wink out of sight. Tales of folks forcibly abducted by assorted odd creatures and taken to strange rooms or alien craft are so well known and ingrained in today's popular culture that I hardly need lay out an example here. In addition to beaming up, people may recall being carried through walls or transported by other methods that indicated they'd entered some other world where our normal rules of physics don't apply. My question is simply, why do areas with many UFO sightings also seem to attract strange creatures, anomalous lights, and rolling green mists, or vice versa? What do all these phenomena have in common that attract them to the same places? Perhaps we're looking too hard at the characteristics of the phenomena and not hard enough at the relationships they display. Do they show up, for instance, in all creature-related sightings, or just some? I didn't find any at all in the chapter on bedroom invaders, even in my own event in which the invaders looked like classic gray aliens and appeared to walk through a wall. Other phenomena, however, go hand in hand with UFOs, sometimes even when unnoticed by eyewitnesses to strange creatures. It may be that we can find the connections by looking at these tangential relationships in the same way we sometimes catch glimpses of things out of the corner of our eyes that our frontal vision has missed. Chapter 20. Lights, Crafts, and Chickens. One question I hear often from radio callers, blog readers, and conference attendees is whether I think that unknown upright canids and Bigfoots, especially Bigfoots, are related to UFOs. What people really want to know is whether these humanoid creatures are being brought here from somewhere else. The idea of dogmen as mysterious travelers is actually a concept that's been around for some time. The Egyptian jackal-headed god Anubis, whose description shows up in many reports of weird, upright canine creatures, was considered a guide between Earth and the underworld. The intentions of its contemporary lookalikes are much less clear, but the canine specters in these encounters are still usually perceived as dark beings, both literally and metaphorically. Some theorists swim even further out into these murky waters and suggest that dogmen, Bigfoot, and other cryptids have been genetically modified by the UFO owners and dropped off here to fulfill some unknown purpose. Surveillance of the human population, perhaps. My usual answer to that notion is that while I don't have any reports from witnesses who've seen a dogman hopping directly off a UFO, although I know there are a few cases where people have claimed to have seen Bigfoot in or just outside of one, it does seem that where mystery creatures abound, UFOs may also fly the unfriendly skies. The association between creatures and UFOs might be only circumstantial and speculative, but it does happen more often than would be expected by mere chance. Some geographical areas bear this association out more consistently than others. One such area, the region between Skiesville and Westminster in northern Maryland, was featured on Lon Strickler's Phantoms and Monsters website as a prime, if unlikely, example. These communities lie just west and northwest of the outskirts of Baltimore. The article describes unidentified lights showing up in farm fields just before crop circles appeared. The crop circles preceded an eyewitness report of a Bigfoot standing in the same field. Strickler wrote, "There have been reports worldwide of UFOs and Bigfoot seen in proximity together for quite some time. These incidents of lights, crop circles, and Bigfoot in and around Westminster, Maryland are not surprising. I have received similar reports since the early 1990s. The Rochdale Chicken Rustler. There are reports of this type that date back even earlier, of course. One well-known incident occurred in 1972 in Rochdale, Indiana, about 35 miles west of Indianapolis. The town is best known today for its annual 4th of July cockroach races, started in 1981. But the little town of around 950 people had already achieved a degree of fame for the summer in which the family of Randy and Lou Rogers and 40 to 50 citizens repeatedly glimpsed an 8-foot-tall, wide-shouldered creature over the span of a week and a half in mid-August. One witness said it had an ape-like face and was covered with thick, black and rust-colored fur. The creature's nocturnal appearances had been preceded by several sightings of a large, bright light hovering over nearby cornfields. Bright lights, of course, are not necessarily UFOs, but many investigators believe they can be one and the same, just a different type of craft. Some think the light globes are cleverly designed disguises for nuts and bolts craft, or perhaps a phase of physical manifestation that appears to us as simply a bright light. But even if totally unassociated with UFOs, anomalous light forms often display their own degree of high strangeness, as they seem to interact intelligently with witnesses. In the Rochdale case, however, it was simply there until the creature, or perhaps the ground crew, showed up. The hairy creature's anomalous side was obvious. It behaved as strangely as it looked. It gave off a putrid smell, and on one occasion stared directly into a window of the Rogers family home. It also groaned loudly, usually stood and walked upright, but sometimes also ran on all fours. It was blamed by area farmers for ferociously attacking about 200 chickens, dozens of which died, while the rest were left mauled and bloodied. The creature seemed more interested in mutilating the fowl than eating them. And yet it did not leave any visible tracks and made no noise when it ran through nearby brush. But weirdest of all was that on some occasions it appeared transparent. An article for Strange Magazine quoted Rogers. "The funny thing is that it never left footprints, even in mud, and when it ran through tall weeds, you couldn't hear anything. And sometimes when you looked at it, it looked like you could see through it, like it was a ghost or something." The number of total eyewitnesses was estimated at between 40 and 50, and most of them were not loving the new wildlife in town. Several members of the small community finally chased and fired at it, but the creature just kept running. It wasn't seen again in Rochdale. A surprising number of Bigfoot and UFO sightings have popped up in Indiana, but Rochdale's events occurred only days after the largest solar flare ever measured knocked out communications in several states. If electromagnetic disturbances caused by solar flares are indeed a precipitating factor for appearances of UFOs and creature sightings, mid-August 1972 should show up as a red-letter week for both. Starting with UFOs, I did a quick survey of the UFO Hunters website in its National UFO Reporting Center, NUFORC, files, and found no other UFO reports in Indiana for August 1972. I then checked that month and year for reports in 12 other states with overall relatively high UFO counts. The results weren't what I'd hoped. There were two sightings in Arizona on the first 2 days of August, one in Bloomington, Illinois on the 10th. two in Cincinnati, Ohio on the 10th and 25th, and one in Mount Sterling, Ohio on the 15th. Texas and Wisconsin scored only one apiece, with one in High Island, Texas on the 4th, and a sun-like oval UFO spotted over Waukesha, Wisconsin on the 28th. But California, Florida, Massachusetts, Michigan, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Nevada all turned up blank for August 1972. Thinking I may have simply chosen the wrong states, I decided to check for Bigfoot sightings, which are also well documented online. This proved much more difficult. Results were spotty at best. The one full-out monster hunt I did find in Tazewell County, Illinois, near Peoria, in late July 1972, turned out to be a hoax confessed by a local teen. I wouldn't throw out sun flares entirely based on this small amount of data, but I think more comprehensive data will be needed to find solid connections between UFOs, creature sightings, and other anomalies. In the meantime, we'll move on to a different sort of case. Encounter case summary. The Rochdale Chicken Rustler. Reported creature or creatures. Large, Bigfoot-like creature. Location, date. Rochdale, Indiana, mid-August 1972. Conditions, summer, most often seen at night. Associated phenomena. A large, bright object seen hovering over field before creature appeared. Unexplained actions or appearance of creature. Huge size, repulsive odor, could run on two or four legs, stared in windows of houses, ran completely silently through brush, sometimes turned transparent when looked at directly, moaned loudly, destroyed flocks of chickens. Witness or witnesses, 40 to 50 community members. Environmental factors, rural agricultural area near river. Cornfields at that time of year would have provided otherwise unavailable cover. Solar flares. On August 7, 1972, the largest solar flare ever recorded erupted and knocked out communications in several states. This was an extremely important solar event, and immediately preceded Rochdale's bright light and big hairy creature. The Dundee Disc. Another great example of this type of area is the northern unit of the Kettle Moraine State Forest, which stretches through Sheboygan, Fond du Lac, and Washington counties in Wisconsin. This wooded, well-watered, and hilly terrain is known for numerous sightings of upright wolf-like creatures. The most famous of these is probably the 2006 incident where Steve Kruger, then a contractor for Wisconsin's DNR, stopped to remove a deer carcass from the road and subsequently observed an upright wolf-headed canine remove that deer carcass from his truck. This Wisconsin region is also known for Bigfoot sightings, and a bit southward in Washington County, other mysteries such as Holy Hill, a rise sacred since ancient times to Native Americans that is now used as a Roman Catholic shrine, and a local Goatman legend that may date back to the Civil War era. The area is probably best known for its UFO activity, however. A sighting in the city of Hartford, in fact, was named one of the top 10 UFO cases of 2012 by the Mutual UFO Network, MUFON. The title-winning incident occurred July 13, 2012, when a resident in her 50s and her daughter both saw a silent, lamp-shaped object equipped with lights and measuring about 200 feet long float over the trees in their yard and then shoot away in classic UFO style. The sighting lasted about half a minute, which is longer than most sightings of unknown phenomena of any type. The little town of Dundee, one of Wisconsin's three self-proclaimed UFO capitals, the others are Elmwood and Belleville, has a long history of unidentified flying objects in its skies. A woman I met at a book signing at an area library told me of her sighting just off Highway 67, about 10 miles south of Plymouth, on her family farm in November 1967. Dundee is only about 26 miles north of Hartford and is also adjacent to the Kettle Moraine State Forest Northern Unit. The woman was 10 years old at the time and had been sent to fetch some chickens whose wings hadn't been sufficiently clipped to prevent them from, well, flying the coop. The escapees had found themselves a tree to roost in and seemed determined to stay there. Her task was to pull the stranded hens out of the branches. She was busy doing just that when she saw a large, silent, cigar-shaped craft hovering just above a nearby tree only 40 feet away. The silver craft had small portholes or windows, she said, and on one end were two curved, pipe-like appendages that emitted yellow and blue laser-like lights that appeared to float off on their own. It eventually zoomed off, but the girl had quite a long look at it. She didn't know if the craft's occupants, if any, were aware of her. Her family did not poo-poo the sighting, since one of her aunts had seen a round, disc-like craft hovering over her fishing boat in the same general area. The woman didn't see any unknown creatures in that immediate vicinity, but the farm's location 10 miles south of Plymouth would have put it in the middle of a creek and swamp system leading into the Kettle Moraine State Forest, only 5 or 6 miles away. I've personally investigated 2 Dogman and several Bigfoot sightings in the northern unit, and more of both in the southern. While those sightings aren't necessarily correlated with the Dundee UFO report or any others, it does show that strange creatures and a variety of unidentified flying objects are both very well represented in this same unique area of Wisconsin. But that's just one small example. Encounter case summary. The Dundee Disc. Reported creature or creatures or UFO. Large silver cigar-shaped UFO hovering near witness before zooming off. Had 2 curved pipe-like appendages that emitted colored lights. Location, date, November 1967, 10 miles south of Plymouth, Wisconsin, next to the Kettle Moraine State Forest Northern Unit. Conditions, daylight sighting from only 40 feet away with witness in tree with a very good view. Associated phenomena, family member saw a different craft in the same area near that same time. Unexplained actions or appearance of creature or UFO. Craft was not of known earthly design and made no sound as it hovered and then zipped away. Seemed to be a solid object. Witness or witnesses. A woman who was 10 years old at the time of the sighting. Environmental factors. Located in a water system close to the Kettle Moraine State Forest, near an area known for other UFO sightings as well as reports of Bigfoots and Dogmen. Craft over Canada. Turnabout is fair play. In late December 2014, I was a guest on the Spaced Out Radio online show hosted by Canadian Dave Scott, his professional name. We discussed my usual topic of strange and unknown creatures, and afterward he suggested that I talk to him off the air about his experiences with UFOs, including one that he personally observed disappear into what looked like a portal. He didn't have to suggest it twice. Scott, a longtime radio journalist, had been exploring the realm of unknown phenomena for several years before his sighting. I'd started having psychic experiences and began investigating my own abilities, he said. The more I investigated UFOs, the more I began to see them. One evening, in May 2013, Scott, his wife, and another couple were relaxing on the deck at his home, overlooking the Fraser Valley near Vancouver in British Columbia. It was about 10 p.m. and the temperature was about 60 degrees Fahrenheit as the foursome sat around the fire and chatted. I had said to my friends earlier, "Maybe we'll see a UFO tonight," said Scott. I was half joking and half serious because it had happened before. Within a very short time, he would be proved right. I was looking eastward when I said to my friend, "Hey, there's one," said Scott. I saw something that looked like a dumbbell shape. It was a yellowish-orange rod with silver balls or spheres on each end. We watched it for 10 to 15 seconds while it traveled southeast to northeast. There was no tail, no contrail, and it was probably an inch long in comparison to my finger that I held up at arm's length in front of me. It finally disappeared to our north. There wasn't a cloud in the sky. I told my friends, "See, I told you." They asked me how I knew, and I told them I didn't know how, I just knew. Scott said he also told his friends that he had a feeling the show wasn't over. He was not wrong. I wasn't even halfway through my first beer when I saw a giant triangle above my house made of orange rods connected by silver balls, he said. I said, "Oh my God, what is that?" Scott described it as composed of the same glowing orange rods and silver spheres as the first dumbbell-shaped structure, but this time they were arranged to form a flying pyramid shape. He thought that perhaps the difference between this structure's shape and the first was because they were seeing different views of the same object, but this time it was moving much more slowly. It also appeared to be heading north. "It was moving as if it wanted us to see it," he said. We watched it for about a minute and a half until it flew into a portal. At least that's the best explanation Scott could think of for what the three of them witnessed. His wife had run into the house for a moment and missed it. "The sky was dark," he said, "and as the triangular shape lit by rows of lights progressed slowly over his home, the lights blinked out in sequence, as if disappearing into an unseen opening. It was like it flew into a doorway," he said. "The tips of the lights, the orange-gold rods were the lights, began to disappear." The rest of the structure slowly followed suit, pushing incrementally into the darkness until none of it remained visible. Scott also likened it to something moving behind a black stage curtain. He added that, as with the first structure's appearance, there was no sound or any evidence of engines, as there would be with known Earth craft. His friends were quite disturbed by this spectacle, he said. There was a lot of swearing going on, a lot of questioning as to whether that was real. They immediately left for home. Scott was also in shock at what he had seen. "That was the night I truly got scared," said Scott. "I had seen UFOs before, but not like that. It was the moment where I went, 'Holy cow, UFOs are real.' And I didn't understand the impact it would have on me emotionally. When I saw the craft, it made me question absolutely everything regarding my existence. I remember feeling really mortal and useless, wondering what the purpose of life was then. Nobody told me how to react or what to feel when I saw something like this. All of a sudden, I was questioning my beliefs and wondering where this was supposed to lead me. I didn't sleep well. It consumed me and my thoughts. I had troubles concentrating on anything else because I needed to know what it was that I saw. I knew it wasn't human or man-made. Now, after everything I've learned, I consider that sighting as a gift. But at the time, I remember questioning everything on an emotional and spiritual level." The thing that makes me tremble a bit at this story is that if there really was a portal in the night sky of Canada into which that UFO disappeared, it must have been both big and undetectable by normal human senses. We don't know whether government aviation and military surveillance can detect these things either. And if there was one such opening, why wouldn't there be others, all over, equally invisible in daytime skies? There could be myriads of them all around our planet, and we would have no way to know. Of course, the craft may have just been turning the lights off in sequential order to give the illusion that it was passing into a gateway. Or perhaps it was passing into something other than a gateway, such as a completely camouflaged, larger craft. I'm not sure that I like the implications of that any better than the idea of a sky portal. And again, the real question remains, who is driving these things? Are they tourists, reconnaissance personnel, or something utterly beyond our understanding? And most important, are they dropping off representatives that closely resemble our most common, highly intelligent, and formidable animals? Researchers such as author Whitley Strieber proposes that the UFOs and their inhabitants may be some type of quantum collaboration between other intelligences and humanity's observation of them, our observation being the catalyst that brings them into our reality. He suggests the principle of quantum physics, which shows the tiniest particles of matter behave according to human awareness of them, may apply to the visitor experience in his bestseller, Communion. The very act of observing it may be creating it as a concrete actuality, says Strieber. Encounter case summary. Craft over Canada. Reported creature or creatures or phenomena. UFO. Location. Date. 10 p.m. May 2013. Fraser Valley near Vancouver in British Columbia. Conditions. Clear, warm evening. Associated phenomena. UFO disappeared as if entering an unseen portal in the sky. On April 3, 2013, an unrelated party reported a nighttime sighting over Vancouver described as green crafts and dark shadow crafts. Unexplained actions or appearance of creature or UFO. UFO seemed to change shape from triangle to pyramid, moved slowly overhead as if intending the witness should see it, disappeared by degrees into an unseen point of entrance, or was able to turn off lights sequentially so that it gave that impression. Witness or witnesses. Scott, his wife, two friends. Environmental factors. Fraser Valley is a spectacular basin of the Fraser River and was covered by a glacier in the last ice age, resulting in a richly watered agricultural area combined with a panoramic variety of topographical features. British Columbia is noted for Bigfoot and UFO sightings. Solar flares. On May 15th, the sun hurled a mass coronal ejection in the direction of Earth that was expected to hit on May 17th, and on the 17th, an M3-class flare almost directly facing the Earth was detected. Activity rating was high for the mid to latter part of that month. Chapter 21, Bigfoot in Chicago. Despite the spectacular examples of Skinwalker Ranch reviewed earlier here, eyewitness accounts of Bigfoot or other creatures caught in the act of entering or exiting unidentified light objects or portal-like structures in the sky are fairly rare in the annals of cryptid lore. Reports of unknown lights simply spotted in the same vicinity as sightings of strange creatures, however, occur more frequently. Anomalous lights, as we've noted throughout this book, can manifest in myriad shapes. Sometimes they form spheres or columns, other times they resemble craft-like UFOs. They may or may not display obvious connections with other phenomena, but establishing that odd lights are frequently seen in hot spots of cryptid sightings is important to our study. Here is an older but previously unpublished report of an incident that occurred in a Chicago forest preserve where a decades-long history of strange lights and sounds preceded sightings of a hairy bipedal creature and a UFO. A retired state and federal government worker with a degree in biology from Northeastern University contacted me in February 2015 to share his creature encounter, the memory of which he'd been trying unsuccessfully to banish since 1967. He asked that his name be withheld, so I will call him John Turner. Turner had set out at sunrise on one warm August morning of that year to ride his new bike on some forest preserve trails in an area along the Des Plaines River, known as Robinson's Forest and Schiller Woods. The trails lay just east of Chicago's O'Hare Airport. "I didn't know anything about Bigfoot," he told me. "I was just planning to have a fun trip." He took his Schwinn Varsity 10-speed along a dirt path that led to an asphalt trail along the river's west bank, walking the bike where the path became too rough. Along the way, he decided to stop and rest for a few minutes on a fallen log, overlooking the river that flowed dappled with gold from the sunrise behind the woods on the other shore. As Turner sat, drinking in the scene's beauty, he began to sense something unusual about the place. A remarkable thing I noticed was that I heard a bird whistle, some type of exotic bird I never heard before, he said. It happened 4 or 5 times. A couple walked by on the trail as I sat there, and the lady said she heard it too. He decided to move farther along the trail, still walking his bike, and soon came to another good vantage point for watching the sunrise. A patch of 5-foot-tall ragweed plants just coming into pollen season separated him from the bank, he said, but he was still able to see through the fronds. Turner noticed an orange glow from what he assumed was the dawn's light shining through the trees, and then quickly realized the waters harbored something much less tranquil. "I was just sitting there, imagining how the area must have looked back when the Native Americans would paddle down the river," said Turner, "when I saw what first looked like a shadow of a figure. It was big and tall, with a cone-shaped head, but man-like, and it was coming out of the woods where I saw the glow. It walked and stood erect, with its head up." Turner added that it was pulling on some vines that hung off the trees as it walked toward the edge of the river's east bank, about 80 feet away. Once it had fully emerged from the woodline, Turner realized this was no shadow. It was a dark-furred creature that stood about 6.5 feet tall, he said. Turner stands 6'1", and he estimated its weight at about 300 pounds. It seemed oblivious to Turner's presence as it slurped water from its cupped hands and then swirled the shallows of the riverbank with its fingers, as if hunting for crayfish or other small edibles. The creature was manlike, but covered with jet-black hair about 4 inches long everywhere except for its dark gray, leathery face, said Turner. He estimated that he watched it for about 2 minutes, his mind racing for some rational explanation for the being. And then, to his horror, he began to feel a tickle behind his tongue from the nearby ragweed. Although he tried mightily to fight down the urge to cough, the ragweed got the best of him, and he had to clear his throat. The creature immediately straightened at the sound and began to look for him, peering across the water in Turner's direction. Afraid the creature would find him, Turner crept with his bike around the ragweed patch to a different vantage point. He could no longer see the creature on the opposite shore, but what happened next made him very glad he had moved. Turner had neither seen nor heard the creature cross the water, but he suddenly spotted it on his side of the river, dripping wet and only about 30 feet away from where he then stood. That meant it had either swum or waded across the river in 5 minutes or less, estimated Turner, with no audible splashing. Luckily, it hadn't yet found his new hiding place. Turner hardly felt comforted by that, however, as he saw the creature pull 4 or 5 large, flat stones from the river bottom and toss them one by one, right at the spot where Turner had been sitting when he coughed. Turner watched it hoist one of the slabs over its head and then slam the huge missile at his recent position. "It had pinpoint accuracy," he said. "It was trying to flush me out." Unfortunately for Turner, the ragweed was still close by, and he couldn't stifle another cough. The creature immediately turned to where Turner now stood, and the two of them shared a moment of mutual surprise. "I looked at him, he looked at me," said Turner. Even in his shock, he drank in the details of the creature's physique. There were places on its thighs and buttocks where the wet hair had separated, to reveal brownish, charcoal-colored skin. Turner wasn't sure what sex the creature was since it was covered with too much hair to see genitalia. The creature appeared to have no neck, and the hair on its head was much longer than on its body, falling to its shoulders like a cape. There was also a spot on its head where the water had slicked its hair far back enough that Turner could see an ear. "It was big on the side of its head, like ours," he said, "except it was a little pointed." Turner added that it looked more muscular than heavy, as he could see its muscles flexing beneath the skin as it moved. Its arms were very long, and it had large hands with black nails. The nails were also long, but they were blunt at the ends, a few of them broken. Turner knew with a prickle of sick dread that whatever this creature was, it could easily best him in a fight. The creature had been checking him out during that long moment, too, and it suddenly took action. "He made a quick bluff charge," said Turner. "He then picked up three smaller rocks that were just lying there on the ground somewhere and threw them like fastballs by a baseball pitcher. One hit the rubber tire of his bicycle, and another glanced off Turner's forearm as he tried to shield his head from the assault. Turner began to run back along the trail as fast as he could while pulling his bike and realized the creature was chasing him. The creature howled twice, the sound reminding Turner of the long rising moan of an air raid siren. He felt the hairs rise on the back of his neck. "He was following right on me," said Turner, "and he came right up behind me so fast. I could hear him making mumbo-jumbo noises, like someone talking backward. He had a language." Turner performed an imitation of the sound, a deep-throated string of syllables that I know I would not want to hear from anything chasing me. Regarding the mumbo-jumbo language, we've noted that vocal attribute several times in the book, not just in Bigfoot encounters, but also in relation to upright canines. "At the same time the Bigfoot was chasing him and making that sound," said Turner, "he could hear other similar voices screaming from across the river and assumed they were the friends and family of his pursuer. It was like the gates of hell were open," he said. "The creature was within an arm's distance behind me while the others were calling to it. I thought it was going to get me, that I was dead. I said out loud, 'Oh, Jesus, help me, help, help.' And the minute I said that, it was gone. It went poof and disappeared. I looked across the river and saw a bunch of dark shadows as they, the group of other creatures, went back into the forest on the east side." Turner didn't stop to question his fortunate escape, but continued straight for the parking lot. When he reached it, he said, he dropped down on his knees and thanked God for saving him. He felt like he had been in some sort of Hollywood monster movie, he added. There was a young girl in the parking lot who was about to head down that same bike path, he said, and he told her not to go, that there was a crazy, hairy, wild man throwing rocks out there. She heeded his advice and left. He said the same thing to a man standing by a parked truck, but was dismayed that the man seemed less inclined to believe him. Turner didn't argue. He just headed home, horrendous images churning in his mind. "The creature's face was most memorable," he said. He described its nose as resembling a pug dog's, or a human nose that had been broken so it was flattened. Its forehead sloped back to a point, or sagittal crest. Its eyes were large, round, and entirely black, and Turner said it appeared the creature was having some trouble seeing him. "He was blinking a lot, like the sun bothered his eyes," said Turner, "and as he blinked, I could have sworn they were reflecting, like mirrors." "The eyes weren't completely reflective, as they were still black in color," he added, "but as the large pupils moved back and forth, Turner would catch glimpses of a reflective surface within them." "The creature then steadied his eyes," said Turner, "and began to turn his whole head from side to side in order to get a better look at the intruding human." He noticed another odd thing, too, which was that the park seemed to go oddly silent during the encounter. There were no sounds from any animals or birds. It was just the creature, the river, and me. The astute will recognize another case of the Oz factor. Living with monstrous memories. Turner later tried telling a few people about the creature, but was ridiculed by all. He then tried to put it out of his mind for 45 years, but eventually decided he wanted some closure about the experience, even though he never doubted that the experience had been real. "When I retired, I started reflecting on my life," he said, "and this came back into my mind. I wasn't drunk or taking drugs, and I know I wouldn't have run from nothing. I never dreamed there was any kind of creature like that at all until I saw one myself." He still regrets that he didn't have a camera with him that day. In July 2014, Turner took his wife back to visit the site of his experience. They poked around the area and discovered a sort of hut made of logs stacked upended around a tree. It was tall enough that Turner could stand up inside, he said, and the place smelled rank and musty, like an old carpet you put outside after a dog has lain on it for a long time. It could have been a Bigfoot's hunting blind, but since this is a public park, it's likely that humans made it. I visited the area and the hut with Turner in 2015, and while the structure was impressive, the walls were obviously constructed by humans. An empty beer can lay crumpled near the entrance. Still, as I noted earlier in the section about such structures, that doesn't mean it couldn't also be used by a Bigfoot when partying teenagers aren't around. It seems likely that any Bigfoots inhabiting the preserve when Turner was a young man have probably long since left the area. Low-flying jets zoom overhead continually, and the preserve is filled with running, hiking humans on weekends. Still, I saw two deer and found a trackway of definite wolf prints during my visit, showing that other types of wildlife still find the preserve habitable. The Forest Preserve has a backstory, too. Turner had chosen that particular park for a ride on his new bicycle that day in 1967 because he was interested in a local historical figure, Alexander Robinson. Robinson, an early settler and chieftain who was part Scottish, part Ottawa, was awarded land in what is now the nearby Chichipinqua Forest Preserve, or Robinson Woods, for his help with treaty negotiations between the U.S. government and several different tribes. He was buried in a small cemetery that, along with most of this forest preserve, has long been believed haunted. Turner said he had heard of sightings of mysterious lights accompanied by eerie sounds in the vicinity of that cemetery. There were rumors of a deer that shapeshifted, he added, and people said they could smell lilacs in winter there. UFOs over Chicago. More to the immediate point, this forest preserve area lies just east of O'Hare International Airport, the site of a famous UFO sighting on November 7, 2006. There were at least 12 witnesses to a daylight flyover of a metallic gray disc, and the group included United Airways staff and pilots. The craft hung in the sky over gate C-17 for several tantalizing minutes at about 4:15 p.m., before zipping up into a cloud layer at such a great speed that it left a round hole revealing clear blue sky beyond, exactly like other reports of aerial portals. The hole then shrank back to full cloud cover. The event garnered headlines nationwide and is still a popular search item on the internet. Of course, that event occurred almost 40 years after Turner's experience, so I checked to see if there were any sightings recorded at a date closer to his sighting. To my own surprise, I did find another report of a Chicago-area UFO in the summer of 1967. It occurred at dusk on either July 12th or August 12th, depending on the reporting organization consulted, the National UFO Reporting Center, NUFORC, or the Mutual UFO Network, MUFON. The location was Edison Park, which lies only 2 or 3 miles northeast of the forest preserve where Turner saw the large creature and the screaming shadow figures. According to these accounts, two 15-year-old young men witnessed a 12 to 14-foot dull white triangle slowly traversing the Chicago and Northwestern Railroad tracks at about 60 feet directly above the power lines and heading northwest. They had just exited a house on Northwestern Highway where one of the boys lived when they were greeted by the amazing sight that was fully visible from the home's backyard. The silent craft soon glided away as it continued its northwest trajectory above the tracks and power line. The boys thought about telling their family members still gathered indoors, but decided no one would believe them. Like Turner, they kept the incident to themselves for over 40 years, until 2007, when one of them decided to report it to the two major UFO tracking groups noted earlier. If the August date was correct, it might even have been the same week Turner took his fateful bike ride. At any rate, the UFO sighting was close enough to Turner's encounter in both date and location to be noteworthy. Whether or not the UFO and the Bigfoot were truly related, of course, cannot be proved, and I should add that Turner was very surprised to learn of that UFO. The Wall of Silence. Of course, the fact that there was a UFO sighting at nearly the same time and in the same vicinity as Turner's experience doesn't prove or disprove anything about the creature's level of reality either. But while the Bigfoot behaved in a way completely appropriate to the physical world as it explored and utilized the park's environment, there were a few other parts of this sighting that fall closer to the side of high strangeness. One was the remark Turner made about the uncanny silence in his surroundings during the encounter, hearing only the creature, the river, and himself. This wall of silence, often described by witnesses of unknown creatures, UFO encounters, and various paranormal situations, is akin to the zone of fear and Oz factor phenomena discussed earlier. The biggest question in that regard is why a close encounter with Bigfoot, especially if it is just an undiscovered, fully natural animal or even close human relative, would induce such a profound silence. We have already discussed possible psychological conditions, such as derealization, that resemble the Oz factor, but simply knowing that this phenomenon of silence can be induced doesn't explain why it happens during encounters with Bigfoot. Tom Burnett and Rob Riggs have yet another name for this phenomenon. They call it the eerie silence. In Bigfoot, exploring the myth and discovering the truth, and also connect it with Bigfoot, lights, and UFOs. They write, "Not only are there long-term established histories of Bigfoot-type creature sightings near the Big Thicket, Texas, and Brown Mountain ghost light locations, but a brief survey of the available literature will show the Yakima Indian Reservation lights in Washington, the Gonzales light in Louisiana, the Gurdon light in Arkansas, and the Hornet Spook light location in Missouri, to name a few, also have histories of numerous and repeated sightings of mysterious hairy primates nearby to where the lights occur." Burnett and Riggs have proposed that all these cases may have something to do with the interactions between the magnetic fields of humans and the magnetic fields of the natural landscape, and perhaps unknown forces or intelligences. Again, there's that suggestion of a quantum collaboration. They have done experiments that showed compasses will often malfunction near known sightings of Bigfoots and mysterious lights, and believe this may be a significant key to the mystery. When the eerie silence dawns, it may be like the dead canary in a coal mine, and serve as a warning that the creatures are nearby, employing their mental projection of magnetic energy, they write. Whatever causes cars to stall and their electrical systems to black out when Bigfoots are around might also short-circuit nervous systems, or induce dormancy and helplessness in their intended prey in the wild. When human beings are subjected to this weird effect, it has mystifying and sometimes terrifying results. This, of course, brings to mind the incidents explored earlier here, where green mists and spook lights have shut down electronic systems in cars. As Riggs explained it in his earlier book, In the Big Thicket, On the Trail of the Wild Man, we have seen that the wild man creature sightings are associated with the mysterious energies that sometimes manifest as light forms. These lights, which recur in the same locations for generations in the form of the ghost light phenomenon, also have a peculiar relation to the consciousness of the observer. We have speculated that these energies may be evidence of a form of non-localized consciousness, and that as such constitute a sort of field of psychic energy that may be as much a part of our natural environment as the air we breathe. Riggs also posited that the Sasquatch might be so much more aware of and able to utilize these energy fields that they possess what looks to us like advanced psychic abilities, including the power to influence human minds telepathically or make themselves appear to vanish. He cites a study by Anne Slate and Alan Berry discussed in their 1976 book, Bigfoot, in which they come to the conclusion that according to a number of cases they examined from around the United States, there were times when it almost seemed as if the creatures could make themselves invisible and disappear in a split second. It wasn't a thought that any of the men warmed to or liked to discuss, yet inexorably it would surface. Were there spiritual or other unknown forces at play? The invisibility question. Getting back to Turner's experience in Chicago, the fact that the creature seemed to vanish as soon as Turner called for help also adds an otherworldly aspect to this Bigfoot encounter. After all, Turner heard no splashing sound as it ran into the river, no sound of heavy footfalls running back the other way. Turner emphasized the creature's undetected exit as he added during our first phone interview, "It just disappeared in an instant." One minute, the 19-year-old was within a long arm's length of a huge, muscular creature, and the next, there was nothing behind him except the path, trees, and river. The creature's hobble-gobble vocal utterances suddenly ceased, as did the screaming from the shadows across the river. Scene ended. Was the creature able to dive into the forest, undergrowth, or water in total silence? Or did it perhaps possess the ability to simply stop appearing in our world, whether by entering a portal to elsewhere, telepathically cloaking itself so as to seem invisible, or by other unknown means, such as Riggs and Burnett's theory of natural manipulation of existing electromagnetic fields? Claims that Bigfoots can disappear or turn transparent, as in the Roachfield, Indiana case discussed earlier, do crop up regularly among sightings reports. These reports range from discoveries of footprints in snow or mud that suddenly end, as if the creature had vanished, to eyewitness accounts of seeing a Sasquatch seem to melt into the air. Janet and Colin Board recorded a classic account of the latter phenomena in Alien Animals from a Uniontown, Pennsylvania woman who went outdoors with a shotgun one evening after hearing a suspicious noise on her front porch. When she flung open the door, there, lit by the porch light and only 6 feet away, stood a 7-foot-tall Bigfoot-like creature with its arms raised as if in attack mode. The woman instinctively aimed at its torso and shot it at point-blank range, an act that had little to no effect. But amazingly, the BHM, the board's abbreviation for Big Hairy Monster, just disappeared in a flash of light, said the boards. The woman's son-in-law saw several of the creatures later that night, clustered at the tree line of a neighboring woods, and described their very long arms and red eye shine, traits commonly reported by Bigfoot witnesses. He also saw an unexplained red light lurking just above the tree canopy, which is again very reminiscent of the episode in Rochdale. Turner did not notice any flashes of light as he fled along that path just east of O'Hare Airport. I asked Turner what he thought really happened to the creature chasing him, and he replied, "I think he stopped short of catching me because I was getting closer to the parking lot, where people gather. I suspect he made a dash into the brush to join the others who were berating him." Most people would consider that the likeliest scenario. Of course, Turner hadn't turned around to see where the creature actually went. He was too busy running for his life. Why no attacks? It's natural to ask why the Bigfoot didn't pounce on Turner in a few big bounds. After all, the unencumbered creature should have been able to catch Turner, who was dragging a bicycle along the path for almost half a mile as he fled. But it's common for witnesses who report being chased or followed by upright hairy creatures to feel that although the creature didn't get them, it easily could have. In Turner's case, it seems to me as if the chase was actually a long, territorial bluff charge intended to scare Turner away, especially given the strange language-like sounds it made as it ran. Much of what happened in Turner's encounter, in fact, is common in Bigfoot reports, and also squares perfectly with our known laws of physics. Unusual bird calls, for instance, like the exotic-sounding tweets Turner described in the beginning of his experience, are believed by many researchers to mean there are Sasquatch in the area. Most researchers presume they are made by the creatures, as signals between one another, perhaps to warn that the humans are near. Turner's scary near-pelting with rocks is another very common feature of many Bigfoot encounters. His observation that the creature was able to peg large stones with great finesse is well attested in the annals of Bigfoot lore. Turner's description of the Bigfoot both pitching rocks overhand and by thrusting them from above its head with both hands strikes me as a very realistic detail. It makes his story unique, since in most instances of rock pelting, people don't actually see the rocks being thrown. I agree. Having witnessed this phenomenon firsthand in 2015 while on a Wisconsin trail where Bigfoot activity had been reported, a colleague was in the process of shaking a small tree in an effort to stir up activity when a rock hit him on the side of his head. I was looking in the general direction the missile had to have come from, but saw no trace of the perpetrator, and it was unlikely a human could have made that accurate throw from the brambly underbrush without my seeing him or her. The rock wasn't large, but hit my colleague hard enough that he received a mild concussion. Widespread similar reports have led to the suggestion by some that perhaps forest rock showers are the result of poltergeist activity rather than the act of a super athletic primate. But I think Turner's encounter shows that Bigfoots can and do throw rocks at people. It still doesn't tell us why they do it, but I'd guess that the creature very much wanted Turner to leave its domain. Winkin' and Blinkin'. Turner's description of the creature also sounds like that of a physically present natural animal. It certainly required a great deal of strength to hoist those flat rocks over its head and sail them at the spot where it thought Turner was sitting. The animal's appearance also hewed very closely to those reported in the thousands of Bigfoot sightings recorded around North America over the past 50 or 60 years, adding surprising but realistic details, such as the color of the skin where the hair lay parted after the creature swam, and the glimpse Turner had of one ear. Its noticeable blinking and squinting, along with what seemed like transparent mirror reflection from its eyes, was something I hadn't heard before, however. It makes sense, though, that if this creature was usually nocturnal, then it might have trouble seeing well in bright morning light. Or perhaps it was simply farsighted. The mirror reflective eyeballs are not so easy to explain, but I do have a theory based on other witness sightings and on a recent observation of my own. Many reports of nighttime encounters with Bigfoot have insisted that the creature's eyes glowed red, often comparing them to LED lights or lasers. That shouldn't happen, since primate eyes are not normally equipped with the tapetum lucidum, a membrane behind the retina that allows the eyes of nocturnal creatures to reflect light and see better in the dark. The eyes of animals that possess the membrane will shine brightly in the beam of a flashlight or headlights, but normally wouldn't glow of their own accord in the absence of direct light. My speculative layman's idea is that perhaps Bigfoots have developed some kind of convergent eye structure that functions a bit differently from the standard tapetum lucidum, so that it has the ability to super reflect even small amounts of light that appear as glowing red. But since Bigfoots have also been observed functioning well in daylight, this structure would have to be self-adjusting.